Well, thank you, Rick, and thank you, What Do You Think, Inc.? That does not mean that a corporation is a person, you know, because What Do You Think, Inc. is Rick and Lindsay, and so thank you, Rick and Lindsay, for, again, really sponsoring this, getting all the information out, organizing it, getting us set up here. Again, thank you, Bibi and Anisquam Village Church, for having us back in this beautifully renovated space. And so I'm really delighted to be back here again for this series of four Wednesday nights in which we will be exploring shamatha and vipassana once again. So we'll be doing this again. It will be familiar, but a little deeper probably than anything that you might have heard from me anyway. And also with some different slants on it, because we'll be bringing in some different sources. And so, especially in the Vipassana section, so we will be using Mahamudra sources. Dzogchen largely, and the Dzogchen of Dujom Lingpa lineage for shamatha practice, largely, and with just a few slants from Mahamudra. And then largely, though, the Vipassana, when we get into the Vipassana section, that will be primarily the Mahamudra approach to Vipassana. And so some people, so the two lineages basically that I'll be citing and I am immersing myself in right now are the lineage, Dzogchen lineage of Dujom Lingpa, the Dujom lineage, which began with Dujom Lingpa, whose dates are 1835 to 1904. And this is what I have been studying with Lama Alan Wallace for 8 years or so now, and is the primarily what he has been teaching in these two-month retreats that Rick and I were at last year and I've been going to for a number of years. So there are five primary texts that Lama Alan has been teaching over the course of 7 years. And so much of that goes into, we'll be just skimming a few of the highlights of shamatha in that approach. But then the other approach that I am just beginning to immerse myself in, that, well, I've been very interested in this for a couple of years now, and have been teaching this, little snippets of this in past retreats. And this is the teachings in the texts of the ninth Karmapa, Wangchuk Dorje. And so his dates are 1556 to 1603. These are, is really the seminal text for all of the Mahamudra tradition, especially of the Karmakagyus. He wrote three primary texts, the shortest of which is called Pointing Out the Dharmakaya, and the longest of which is called Ocean of Definitive Meaning. And that's the encyclopedic version, and the shorter version is the one that we'll be taking some snippets from in our Vipassana approach. And we'll be following the basic outline of that text of Pointing Out the Dharmakaya. In that basically the first step, there are basically three practice or three sections of that brief text. The first is the preliminaries, then there's the main text and the conclusion. And the preliminaries are very, very similar to the Dzogchen preliminaries that we have been doing of Dujom Lingpa. So, and a number of us were at a teaching in August in Boston of Khandro Rinpoche, who went into some detail, for one night anyway, on these preliminaries. But the preliminaries are pretty much the same. We won't have time in this four sessions to go into the preliminaries, but I'm hoping that you're familiar with those and that you can also consult this text, Pointing Out the Dharmakaya. And the text, when you, if you are interested and go looking for this, what you're going to find is that the text itself is very, very difficult to find, a translation of the text. There's only one translation of it by Nalanda Bodhi in Seattle. And it's, you know, it's a slender volume, but it's $65 for that one, and with some requirements in order to get it, you know, that you have to have your, state your bona fides, basically, to your Mahamudra bona fides to get this text. But the what you'll find if you go looking for it is a commentary by Trungpa Rinpoche. So that's what I'll be drawing from, is this commentary on the pointing out the Dharmakaya by Trungpa Rinpoche, who is, according to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, one of the greatest Mahamudra masters living now. He's 85 years old and is the tutor of the 17th Karmapa. And his students have included people like Dzogchen Ponlamp Rinpoche, Thai Sithu, who is the main teacher of Mingyur Rinpoche, on and on. So he is this extraordinary teacher, and it all comes through in his writings and the translations of his writings as well. So we're feel like we're in good hands, and I feel like I have had enough of a transmission from Khandro Rinpoche, who invited us to seek out these texts and immerse ourselves in them, and so I'm doing exactly what she invited us to do. And this will be, for me, a big part of my winter, just going through these three texts in great detail and trying to put them into practice in retreat. So some people have asked already tonight, because the flyer mentioned Dzogchen and Mahamudra. What is the difference between Dzogchen and Mahamudra? And Trungpa Rinpoche states what Karma Chagme has stated, and what most Mahamudra and Dzogchen masters state, is that basically there's not any difference that is worth fighting over or discussing, and you might as well just leave it for the scholars. And that basically you could see the real distinction is Mahamudra is a Kagyu lineage and has its own Kagyu sources that come from Saraha. The lineage basically comes from Vajradhara. Saraha promulgated it in India. And then 84 Mahasiddhas in India, and then Tilopa Naropa Marpa. Tilopa Naropa, Milarepa, Gampopa, and then the whole Karmakagyu tradition. And then Dzogchen flows out of Garab Dorje, Padmasambhava, and Vimalamitra. So, but basically the practices are really the same. And what the essence of these practices is all about working directly with your own mind. And so these practices, as the masters continually point out, and as Alan Wallace has pointed out, these practices seem really well suited for modern people of the 21st century in Western culture, because what you don't need is a medieval education, and you don't have to adopt a lot of medieval symbology. You don't have to do anything. The path of that Anuttara Tantra is regarded within Mahamudra as the elaborated path, conceptual elaboration. And anybody who has practiced Tantra knows that it is highly conceptual. You have to visualize things and then know what these mean. You know, so you attach conceptual meaning to things that you're visualizing, and that becomes part of the power of it, but it's highly elaborated practice. So with Mahamudra and Dzogchen, none of that is needed, and so it is, as one of the prophecies for Dujam Lingpa stated, this practice will be especially valuable for the cities of the West and people of the future. And it seems so well adapted for first-person introspective understanding and examination and research on the nature of the mind itself. And it's something that when we do this research ourselves personally, this is what has the power, because it's not conceptual, it becomes direct experience, that it has the power to transform the way that you view the world. So in this Mahamudra lineage, One of the things that Trangu Rinpoche points out is that there were originally 84 Mahasiddhas, meaning these are 84 people who practiced Mahamudra and achieved enlightenment in this one lifetime, practicing Mahamudra. And he points out that the significance of these 84 people is not that we should think of them as just 84 people. You know, this is the full set of people who achieved enlightenment in this lifetime or something, and that now that just becomes a, you know, something that we can approximate or something like that. But what he says is that what's really significant about these 84 is that they represented 84 different lifestyles, everything from kings to fishmongers and street sweepers. And so regardless, Trangu Rinpoche points out that regardless of what your lifestyle is or how busy you are or your occupation, that this is really a path for you, and it has the potential to deliver full enlightenment in this lifetime, regardless of what you're doing, regardless of your lifestyle, regardless if you're a busy parent, you have other obligations, whatever. Mahamudra and Dzogchen can fit right into that and really just become the way that you just kind of infuse your view of everything that you do and lead to the great results. So what I really wanted to start with was, now that everybody is here, so that was just all kind of prologue. I wanted to just think of Lama Marut for a moment. Just because here we are in this really, you know, beautiful group of people. This feels like my sangha. You know, I have a couple of sanghas around the world, but this just feels like home to me. And you know, who do we have to thank for that, really? So I'd say Rick and Lindsay. And what do you think, Inc? But of course, Lama Marut, who came and had his, you know, just energized this Dharma community for so many years with those extraordinary summer retreats that I just hear stories about, never attended one myself. So Lama Marut is such a dear friend of mine, going back to days at Diamond Mountain, and when he used to spend every weekend at my house. I put him up every weekend for a number of years, all through Diamond Mountain, basically. And our breakfasts with four of us in this little rat pack were quite legendary, at least in my own memory. But, you know, there's so many things to be grateful for, you know, in our memories of Lama Marut. And one of them is just, you know, the energy and the humor and the joy that he really brought to his Dharma practice. And, you know, the ferocity also, you know, that's what Marut means. Samati Marut is his ordained name. And Marut means big wind, hurricane. Anyway, I think of him with such great fondness. And I think if we were all to spend 1 minute now in samadhi and direct our awareness and attention to with gratitude, just feeling, letting our mind be filled and our hearts be filled with gratitude and appreciation and good wishes for the journey that awaits Lama Marut. And I would say confidence also about, you know, what awaits him and how he's going to deal with it. If we just spend 1 minute of focused attention, I've got a feeling he'll get the message. saw. So what we're going to be doing over the next four sessions is to really be looking at the nature of the mind. This is really what Mahamudra and Dzogchen, this is what distinguishes these two closely related cousins or fraternal twins almost. What distinguishes them from all of other Buddhist philosophy, practice, and lineage is that you're working directly with the nature of the mind in this very unelaborated, non-conceptual way. And so what we're going to be doing is following the outline of practice and presentation in pointing out the Dharmakaya, which begins with shamatha. And so we're going to spend one night on shamatha tonight. And then it goes right into vipassana practice. And then what it does is really examines, first of all, you develop the stillness, let's just call it, the tranquility of shamatha, and then you examine the nature of that mind that is still. And it becomes then very easy to do when your mind is resting in a non-conceptual state to actually to examine it and to make inquiry about it. And so next week then we will be going into the seven questions of Mahamudra that examine the mind in stillness. So we will be pointing out the mind in stillness, as it's called. These seven questions are just really, really powerful, incisive, and, you know, something to really chew on. Not analytical meditation at all. It is just working with direct experience. You're honing the power of your observation and then just asking questions about what you're viewing. And then on the third week, we will be getting into, again, this very familiar theme of many of you are familiar with from Dzogchen practice of Dujom Lingpa, the theme of stillness and motion. And so, first of all, tonight we're going to establish stillness with shamatha practice, and then we will do vipassana practice on the mind in stillness next week, and then we will be going into the vipassana practice, or could be shamatha practice, of movement of the mind. So you know that in Dujom Lingpa's presentation of Dzogchen, the movements of the mind are actually an object of shamatha practice. But in Mahamudra, just slightly a different flavor, immediately when you go into movements of the mind, you are doing vipassana practice. So we'll do a little bit of each because both of them are so rich and that is so powerful to do the shamatha practice, really develop single-pointedness with the moving appearances of the mind, that you are so well set up to do the vipassana practices then without being distracted by all of the moving appearances. And then the third night will be basically figuring out what movement is and observing movement. So basically the shamatha practice of stillness and motion. And then the fourth night will be, again, the nature of the mind in movement and the nature of appearances. So this, for me, is just absolutely exhilarating terrain. And so where this all begins is with, or really to make sense of all of this, where we're going, will be very helpful to have just a little bit of framework. And so the framework really is the six primary consciousnesses in traditional Buddhist psychology. And so the six are the five sensory consciousnesses, and the sixth then is mental consciousness. So five sensory consciousnesses and then mental consciousness. So the very important thing to do or to know, and then sometimes just so that if you see it, you're not confused. In Mahamudra, actually, it's said that there are 8 primary consciousnesses. And the 7th, footnote, is what we have been calling Klishtamanas. So this is in that devolution of how the world of things comes into existence of Dujam Lingpa. You know, that starts off with substrate consciousness, and then immediately after that is Klishtamanas. So that would be the 7th consciousness, and then the 8th actually is substrate, and substrate consciousness that Mahamudra just puts into one. So they call those basically primary consciousnesses also. But let's just work with our familiar 6. So you have the 5 sense consciousnesses and mental consciousness. So the thing too that is important to know about this, and so important for our practice, is to recognize that the 5 sense consciousnesses are non-conceptual. And all of the... And so if we are engaging our environment or an object, an appearance in our environment, with only sense consciousness, it will be a non-conceptual experience. And you might ask, just review your day and ask yourself, how many times during the day did that happen? It's infrequent, I think, in our busy daily lives, because what happens is that the mental consciousness or mentation, the 6th one, gets involved in sensory perception right from the very beginning. And so what happens in Mahamudra theory, and this is also in cognitive science as well, stating the same thing, is that as soon as there is a non-conceptual sense perception, mentation gets involved and creates a conceptual replica of the sensory object. And then the conceptual replica gets projected onto the sense impression and gets conflated, so that we actually, when we are looking at things out in the seemingly out in the world with sight, sound, primarily smell, taste, tactile sensations, when we come to know the world in that way, largely what we are dealing with is a conceptual projection that has been projected onto the initial non-conceptual sense impression, and the two get conflated and confused in our mind, so that we feel like we are looking at an object out there that has attributes. You know, something that I might like or dislike. So, you know, it doesn't take much analysis to think that attributes that I like or dislike could not possibly be in a sensory object out there. Or otherwise everybody would have the same view of everything. And you could say then that you know, might be leading towards self-existence. You know, that all of the attributes are part of the object itself. But of course, everything that we are perceiving, even though it seems like because of the foundation of our samsaric life is this dualistic consciousness that first of all feels that subject is in here, object is out there, and that what the subject is doing is just getting, you know, unbiased sense reports about the world as it exists out there. And so with Mahamudra and Dzogchen practice, what we are doing is trying to slow the whole process down so that we can actually watch the overlap and the projection occurring, so that we can actually watch and be present with a non-conceptual sensory experience, and then watch as it happens. It happens very quickly, but the mind is actually faster than, and our ability to spot with our shamatha awareness is faster even than the speed of the projection. So we can actually watch the projection happening and watch these two get conflated as what appears to be a single thing out there that has qualities that I like or dislike. And so if it's something that I like, I typically would get attached to it. And if it's something that I don't like, then I would feel aversion for it and try to push it away and get rid of it. Or it could be neutral, which means that it doesn't even rise to the level of getting my attention or, you know, not worthy of my attention. So we have the six primary consciousnesses. And then what we are trying to recognize in our meditation practice is, first of all, to become familiar. So this is all the journey of shamatha. Right from the very beginning, it is all about becoming familiar with non-conceptuality. So this is what we are, you know, really would like the very beginning of our practice, you know, from the very first, most basic practices, all the way through where we're going to end up tonight, awareness of awareness, that basically we're just beginning to recognize that it is not thinking that creates the nature of the mind. And when you are left with, when you are living in this present moment of experience with a basically not, because you do actually have some choice about this, that you are not projecting conceptuality onto appearances, that you can begin to discover what is the nature of the mind that is not imbued with or just taken up with and dominated by conceptuality. So, and what you discover is that conceptuality does not create the nature of the mind. And what you are left with when all basically even sensory appearances disappear is the nature of the mind itself, which is basically just luminous cognizance. So it is the simple knowing and radiance of the mind that allows you to be aware. And you can, that is very sufficient to rest in that and to recognize this nature of the mind. And when you are then on the basis of that, resting in that nature, non-conceptual nature of the mind, you break the duality then that is keeps us basically stuck in samsara. So it's very, very helpful in this Mahamudra and Dzogchen tradition to really think very precisely about what is samsara, because we have through our, you know, Buddhist educations, you know, we can come to have some ideas about samsara as being this realm, as if it's like this body living in Gloucester, or, you know, maybe getting old is samsara, but being young is, you know, a taste of nirvana or something, you know, and that you have to do something, you have to change something in order to experience nirvana, and you have to leave something behind in order to leave samsara. So in these traditions, it's very interesting what it is actually that distinguishes samsara from nirvana. So in your handout, which you will get online, and I'll bring the paper copies next week, so that if you're, you know, want to keep a paper copy, you can add it next week. But so now you'll just have to listen. This comes from Gyatro Rinpoche, who is Lama Alan Wallace's primary Dzogchen teacher, who is now 93 years old in California. who is one of these people who has dual lineages. He's a lineage holder of both Mahamudra and Dzogchen lineages. And so Lama Ellen translated two books of his Mahamudra teachings. And this is from the book that is called Spacious Path to Freedom, which is just this extraordinary compilation of Mahamudra aphorisms from all the great masters kind of laid out in this organized way, you know, for with topics, but bringing in the voices of all these great masters. But this is Gyatso Rinpoche in his own commentary here, says, enlightenment is nothing other than the nature of your own mind. Do not look elsewhere. A mind imbued with conceptual elaboration is a mind of samsara. So there you have it. If you wanted a succinct definition of what is samsara, you know, it is not your zip code. You know, this is it. A mind imbued with conceptual elaboration is a mind of samsara. A mind free of conceptual elaboration is liberated. The very nature of the mind itself is primordially, intrinsically free from conceptual elaboration. So the nature of the mind is free from conceptual elaboration. Something happens to the nature of the mind that, you know, leads us to this existence of samsara. Consequently, when we abide in that state, we are abiding in the essential nature of the mind. That is nirvana. So that makes it all very, very clear then, doesn't it? Conceptuality, it is not that you have to think the right thoughts. You know, as in positive psychology or in some approaches to Sutra Buddhism, you know, that you think virtuous thoughts and develop virtuous thoughts that lead to developing merit and all of this. That, you know, all of that is important on certain stages of the path. But the, you know, when you get to the point of liberation quickly, this is what you have to realize is that it is not a matter of thinking the right thoughts, but that thinking itself is actually keeping you ensnared and enmeshed in samsara. And it is somehow, it is all thought, virtuous, non-virtuous, and neutral, that needs to be transcended if we are going to have this experience of non-duality, liberation, nirvana, and the omniscience of pure Buddhahood. And then this idea is emphasized in another quote from, again, Spacious Path to Freedom. The great Tantra of Samputta states, ideation is the great ignorance that casts one into the ocean of cyclic existence. Abiding in non-conceptual samadhi, there is stainless clarity like space. So the defining characteristic of this mind that is beyond conceptuality is just this sheer luminous cognizance or luminous knowing, just awareness. So it basically just means the luminosity. It isn't really an image of light that you're visualizing, but it is simply the capacity of the mind to make things knowable and to know things. So the cognizance is the knowing of them, and then the luminosity is actually what makes things knowable. So there is this non-dual synergy of luminosity and emptiness in these traditions, that emptiness is not a sheer absence, but it is a radiant consciousness that is basically just this luminous cognizance. This is the essence of the mind. And this is what is left over when you stop conceptualizing the transconceptual mind or the nature or the mind of nirvana. And so in Mahamudra, in the approach to shamatha, there are several different, there's a progression of practices in shamatha that I'm not going to confuse you with those of you who are already well familiar with the Dzogchen approach to shamatha, except for adding one practice to that. And this is right at the very beginning. And so the basic in Mahamudra, it's Trangu Rinpoche points out that basically there is the general point of what you're trying to do. And then everything else, all of the specific instructions are just elaborations of that specific point or the general point. And the general point is do not prolong the past and do not beckon the future. Rest evenly in luminous cognizance that is without conceptualization. So that is the practice of shamatha, what we are trying to do in that. So you don't go off to the past or the future, which is by definition conceptual, right? But we remain in the present with either sensory experience or in just resting in luminous cognizance itself without even sensory impressions. So the awareness that we are going to experience when we achieve shamatha and that we are trying to cultivate in this general instructions, don't chase the past or the future, but just rest in the luminous cognizance of the present. This is always going to be occurring, and you are always going to experience this in the present moment. And here is a somewhat lengthy citation from Karma Chagme's other Mahamudra text that Lama Allen translated called Naked Awareness. And this is in regard to the present moment, you know, and the present, our experience of the present. This unstructured consciousness of the present, the instant that is free of mental engagement, is called Mahamudra. As it is unblemished by contaminations, even though it appears, it is untainted within the three times. This instantaneous consciousness is without resistance to evil and without affirmation of good. It has no path on which to proceed, and it has no mental afflictions or antidotes for overcoming them. Since it does not exist, it is not found even if it is sought. Everything is included in this instantaneous consciousness of the present. So, this is called the embodiment of all the Buddhas. And once you come to this conclusion, there can be no disputing it. This consciousness of the present is the basic ground of all excellent qualities. So there is no inconsistency in regarding it as the ground. This consciousness of the present is not created by anyone. So there is no inconsistency in saying that it is spontaneously present. It does not act as any object of any mind, nor is it any substance, so it is non-dual. This consciousness of the present is free of any basis of superimposition or mistaken denial, for it is the absolute space of phenomena, free of birth, cessation, and remaining, and it is present as the great Dharmakaya. So that is the experience of, and the potential of our experience of the present moment. And the present moment is always going to be found by, first of all, not chasing after the past or the future, but resting, first of all, trying to bring our experience into the sensory, non-conceptual sensory experience, and then we'll discard that as well, and then just rest in the luminous nature of the mind. So the first of these practices in the Mahamudra progression of pointing out the Dharmakaya, there is a progression that goes from beginning with a support, basically five different types of support, and then basically without a support, and then, that's basically it. So with a support or without a support, but each of these has many different subdivisions, and there are many different objects within the support itself. For instance, there can be a mundane support or a sacred support, etc. But a support is what in Dzogchen practice we've been calling shamatha with a sign. So this basically means that there is an object that you are using to focus your attention on, and then you try to maintain, you're training the mind to maintain attention single-pointedly, eventually, on this sign that you choose. And so the first of, in the Mahamudra progression, the first of these that is available to us, or that is taught in this progression, is a coarse, mundane sign of one of the sense consciousnesses. So we're really focusing on one of the sensory image, and the one that is recommended to begin with in the Mahamudra is the visual. And so this is exactly what Padmasambhava also advised in text that Lama Allen translated as natural liberation. So this is the where he says that you begin the progression by starting with a pebble or a stick. And so this is exactly what Mahamudra says also. So this is something that we have referred to for years, you know, start with a stick or a stone, you know, and do that for one day and then move on. But we've never done it, right? We go right into breath meditation, or now even, you know, it's not even breath meditation. You go right into stillness and stillness and movement. So you go right into awareness of awareness, you know, and the most recent ways that Lama Allen is really teaching that part of shamatha, you know. So I think I have gone back to follow these Mahamudra instructions and find them extremely valuable. And so I would like to, basically with our shamatha practice tonight, what we are going to do is start at the very beginning, this first practice of Mahamudra, which is working with a visual image. And then we are going to, and just get familiar with that, and find what we can really learn about that, about non-conceptuality, actually, in our experience of this visual image. Because that is the whole point of what we're trying to do, is to familiarize ourselves with a non-conceptual mind. And then we are going to, as soon as we finish with that, we are going to skip over all of the other intervening shamatha practices that you have learned, and go directly to awareness of awareness. So we're going to start with this very basic approach to non-conceptuality and then go all the way to non-conceptuality without any appearance whatsoever. And the point being that what we are trying to do in our shamatha practice, so this, you know, is probably going to be a time-lapse view of your shamatha practice, but a lot of you have been working on this for a long time now, so you might be able to go right into this. But what I am hoping is that with just these two practices and all the breath meditations that you can insert in between in that progression, that you spend the week then in practice so that you really begin to familiarize yourself with stillness of the mind. And because this will give you something, then you will have the stillness, which becomes the object then, which we begin to inquire about next week. So If there's no stillness, the Vipassana practice on stillness isn't going to be of great value to you except conceptually. But if you can develop, and it's not that difficult to do, many of you know, with these instructions, anybody can do this in a, you know, with some practice. Now back to the stick and the stone and the pebble. The first meditation that we're going to do is just visual consciousness, so a visual image, and it is a coarse image, meaning that you are just looking at something that is right in front of you. So you don't go looking for something and you don't choose something, but it is just whatever is right in front of you. And you just try to view that with it, what is called bare attention. So you try to, in the Buddha's words to Bahia, "O Bahia, in the seen, let there be only the seen," and not analyze it, not identify it, not say, "Oh, that is a chair. Oh, that is the back of John's head. Oh, that is, you know, so-and-so. I like it. I don't like it." All of those, of course, are conceptual superimpositions onto the sensory experience. So what we are going to try to do is to simply be present with the visual image as a visual image and only a visual image. And so if you are able to do that, then to the degree that you're going to do that, you will be resting in a non-conceptual mind. And you will be able to really feel what that non-conceptuality feels like. You will get, you know, a little taste of nirvana, of the non-conceptual mind. And so basically that's the important thing is simply to not project conceptuality, identification, categorization, all of those things that tell you what it is, whether you like it, whether you don't like it, the attributes. If you're seeing something with attributes, with qualities, you're having a conceptual experience that is being projected onto what you're looking at, right? So try to rest in this non-conceptual experience of a visual image. So that is the coarse image. And then in the second practice of Mahamudra, which we are going to combine with the first practice, you choose a subtle image, visual image. And so this would be a smaller image. So something, the first image is a coarse image, something that you are just looking at. You're not seeking it out. You're just looking at the visual field and being present with it. And then with the subtle visual image, you look at something that is smaller. And so you actually select something. So this is both Mahamudra and Padmasambhava suggest a pebble, for one. So it's something small that you have to basically focus your attention down on to this individual thing within the larger visual field. And so one of the things that you... this becomes a very interesting experience as you rest with naked awareness or naked attention focused on the visual. Because you come to realize that this becomes... The reason I think this is so valuable for going directly to awareness of awareness is that the same qualities of your meditative mind and experience of awareness are going to apply also to this visual field. So simply notice, as you are focusing on this object with bare attention, does your mind have to constrict? You know, really, does attention to remain present? Because this is what we're trying to do, is remain present with this sensory object. Does your success of that depend on clamping down on it and really effortful, just attention, you know, like a, like you're going to chisel this into your mind and, you know, then have a memory of it that is going to last forever. You know, like somebody going through the Musée d'Orsay in Paris and taking, you know, on a speed viewing, you know, and just taking pictures of everything, you know, and then going to the next gallery, you know, so got it. You know, so is that what I'm trying to do? Take a picture of the pebble, you know, and just kind of burn that into my mind so that it's there. And is that the way that, that effortful way of doing it? Or do you have to really relax? Do you have to open up and be to simple presence? And this becomes quite a revelation because this is exactly the degree of relaxation that you have to bring to all of your breath meditation and to all of awareness meditation in general in the higher stages where you're dealing with no object whatsoever. So right away, just realize the degree of relaxation. And if your mind is skittering off to the past or the future, what do? You return and relax. Just allow it to be and just relax into the present moment of this visual image. And then the as you're focusing, so what we're going to do, the Mahamudra advice of Trungpa Rinpoche is that, like all the advice that you have heard, short frequent sessions, right? So you can do this actually also within the while you're focusing on an object itself. So we're going to oscillate between the coarse image, so basically just the big picture, whatever is out in front of you, and then narrow it down to something that is that you select. At my meditation spot at home, I sit in front of a window and I have a brick wall in front of me. So that's the coarse object. And I just am sitting there with, you know, being present with the brick wall. And then the object, the subtle object that I shift to is a spot on the window. And so it's very interesting. And so then I'm just present with that spot on the window. It's just a little dust spot on the window for a while. And then I go back out. And so this really helps to keep your mind fresh and engaged and keep it from getting bored and going wandering. And then while we are doing this, you have a chance also. The reason that this can be a powerful practice for you to take up over this week is that you have a chance to kind of isolate all of the things that are so important for breath meditation as well. But it all becomes really, really manageable. This is the easiest of all the shamatha meditations, a visual image. You know, visual sense input is about 80% of all of our sense input. So it's just, you know, right there. And can we, if we can just be there, present with it, then this is going to really empower our breath meditation as well. And the other, so the thing that you're also, that you are going to be practicing here that with this visual meditation that is so applicable to your breath meditation also is this, the power of intention. So what you are, nothing, basically, Chuladasa said that basically your meditation training is all just a matter of a succession of intentions that you apply in, you know, more and more subtle situations, basically, as you progress. But so here your intention is narrowing these, your attention to only one element, the visual consciousness. And so and this, of course, is what is so important, as we've talked about many times now, the power of intention in breath meditation, how you, first of all, narrow the field of your attention to tactile sensations, and then you keep recollecting your intention at the pause after every inhalation. And if you're able to do that, recollecting your intention, you're going to remain continuously engaged with that tactile sensation, those sensations of the breath, all the way to the end of the exhalation. So intention is really, really important. And then mindfulness, basically in the very, very simple meaning of mindfulness, is recollection and remembering. What is your meditation object? So it is just continually remaining engaged with the visual image, the naked awareness, the naked attention, and remembering that this is what I am intending to be my meditation. This is my meditation object, only the visual image. And then introspection. You have the opportunity while you're practicing with this very simple visual image to do the quality control and recognize the instant that your attention goes off, gets bored, and goes off to the past or the future. You have a chance to really begin to develop in this very, very simple format of just working with bare attention. You have a chance to work with intention, narrowing the focus only to the single sense field, mindfulness, and introspection as well. All in with your intention is to remain in the present moment. And then your introspection can alert you to conceptualization creeping in. So the conceptualization could be of two very broad categories. One could be a conceptualization of the object itself, meaning that you are defining it, you are identifying it, you are liking it or you are disliking it. So that could be it. Or your conceptualization could be of something entirely different. Your conceptualization could be of, you know, last week's football game, or, you know, where you're going next Sunday, you know, whether this wind is going to blow all the leaves off the trees and it's already too late to go up north, you know. It could take you to something away from your object entirely. So you can either conceptualize the object, or it could take you away all to fantasizing about the future or the past. And so we're ready to do this meditation. I'm going to give you just one more tip from Mahamudra presentation of Trangu Rinpoche. And that is a couple of very interesting antidotes to dullness and laxity. So one of the things that you will notice, of course, while you are trying to focus on just this sensory information of a visual object, is that the verbalizing conceptual mind doesn't go mute necessarily. There's still just a lot of talk, a lot of chatter going on. So can you begin to develop a relationship just with this very simple meditation that is going to benefit you so much in your breath meditation of just allowing the chatter to continue, but without it capturing your attention? Your attention remains focused on the visual image. And so it becomes something like you're sitting in a restaurant and all of this chatter is going on around you, but it doesn't capture your attention unless somebody says your name. And then it's almost impossible not to. So there are things, of course, that come up in these distracting thoughts that have your name, you know, and that whenever I arises, then, of course, that is going to be powerfully distracting. But all of this is stuff that you can watch while you are focusing on this visual image. And so there are two very interesting antidotes to laxity and excitation that Trungpa Rinpoche suggests. in these beginning phases of Mahamudra, and it's a visualization. So you know that with basically distraction, all of the whole flavor of the antidotes for distraction is basically to put a pin in the valve of the tire. It's overinflated, so you let some of the air out of the tire, some of the energy out that is propelling this mind to just go wandering. So you basically, a lot of the advice is to think about depressing thoughts. You know, the faults of samsara, things like that. You know, basically what you're trying to do is bring down the excitement of the mind. But Trungpa Rinpoche has a very, very effective visualization for this. And that is to visualize at your heart a black upside down lotus. And then visualize in that lotus a black light, black ball. And then just visualize that the ball drops down. So what you're trying to do is basically move the energy from your head down lower in your body. And so you visualize this ball leaving the lotus at your heart and then actually leaving your body through the lower opening and then just going right out down into earth. So this is really a very powerful way of basically releasing energy and bringing the mind down from distraction. And then if your mind is dull and you need more energy, basically the mind is collapsing because there is just nothing going on with this visual image and I'm about to fall asleep. I'm so bored with it. What you do is you visualize a white lotus. So the black lotus is facing down. The white lotus is facing up and there's a radiant ball of white light then in that. White lotus, and you visualize that then ascending through the central channel so that it leaves the crown of your head and then just goes off into space. So it really expands your consciousness and brightens your consciousness, and that, you know, often depending on the degree of laxity or excitation, you know, that could do it right there. But that, along with all of the other, I just mentioned that as along with all of the other antidotes to excitation and laxity that you already know. So let's do a meditation. So we had better make this just a 6-minute meditation so that you can get the flavor of this. And then I encourage you to put this into practice over the week. So find a comfortable position. This coarse visual image, let that be the only thing that fills your attention. So this is your intention. Narrow the scope of your attention to only this single sense field, the visual. So give it bare attention without any conceptual projection. Feel the degree of relaxation of this awareness that is able to remain present. And now choose a more subtle object, something within the visual field in front of you, to narrow the focus of your visual awareness to just this. Mindfulness is what keeps you connected to this object you have chosen. By continually recollecting, and then shift your visual awareness again back to the big picture right in front of you. Again, it's bare attention. In the scene, let there be only the scene. And then shift back again to the smaller object, the more subtle object. Intention is what moves your attention. Mindfulness is what keeps it connected. Introspection tells you whether you are becoming distracted or dull. Notice the feeling of non-conceptuality of this present moment. So I find that meditation very, very helpful. And you can use basically, as follow this Mahamudra progression. The list of supports then goes through all of the sense fields. We maybe should have chosen sound for this one. but then also basically leading you right into what I call beach meditation, right? Because what you are trying to do is to, with intention, just narrow the scope of your awareness to only sensory input. So when you go out to the beach, it's very easy to just narrow it to sight. If you're looking down on just at the sand in front of you and the sound of the surf and then tactile sensations of the wind on your face and all of that, see if you can make it to the end of the beach.
So you're allowed to do all the senses at once.
Yes. So okay. So basically you could. So that, yeah. So that's just, you know, you're just choosing. Yeah. And of course, it's helpful to have your eyes open while you're walking. And the sound is really going to dominate. So you can do that. And then you also basically use the same approach when you choose breath meditation as the practice that you're doing, because what you're doing is then just focusing on the tactile domain. And what you're doing is following the tactile sensations of the breath. But so this is basically what we're trying to do. That is just a brief introduction to get you to begin to recognize stillness or non-conceptuality and really begin to, I think, or experiment and realize that this is really within reach. You can have all throughout the day experiences of non-conceptuality if you choose to. If you really just make this part of your practice and part of your intention, it is not out of reach or something that just happens at the culmination of your practice when you achieve shamatha. But you can really begin to cultivate non-conceptuality immediately, right now. And even with this very, very basic practice of shamatha. But we are going to move right along to the shamatha without a sign. So in the essential instructions of the Mahasiddha Maitripa, he says that there are three types of shamatha practice. The first is shamatha practice focused on a sign, then shamatha practice focused on conceptualization, and then shamatha practice focused on non-conceptualization. So the second one is what we're going to be doing in the third week. So this is the simultaneous stillness and motion of Dujom Lingpa, where your shamatha practice is actually focused on the conceptualizing mind and the movement of it, and you're taking conceptualization as basically your breath meditation. The object that you're choosing, that you're mindfully engaged with, is the ever-changing parade of mental appearances. So that is the second one. But we're going to go right into, because what we're really interested in is stillness right now. So that is the movement component. It's actually more difficult than the stillness. The stillness itself, as a standalone practice, just awareness of awareness, is not that difficult. And it's really enjoyable. And so I invite you over the course of the week then to experiment with this third one, the ultimate quiescence of maintaining the attention upon non-conceptualization. And this is the way that the Mahasiddha Maitripa explains that or describes it. He says, "Let the mind, like a cloudless sky, be clear, empty, and evenly devoid of grasping, and settle in utter vacuity. By so doing, you will experience the quiescence of joy, clarity, and non-conceptuality." So you know that these are the three attributes of shamatha in Dujom Lingpa's practice: non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss. So you can, even before you achieve shamatha, when you are just resting in this non-conceptual state of awareness of awareness, this is a large part of your experience, is non-conceptuality and luminosity. And then bliss just as part of your experience, but it's really non-conceptuality and luminosity that is what you are resting in. So in this practice, then, we are going to eliminate, so what we began with, this radical progression of going from the beginning to the end without any middle, is first of all, beginning to experience non-conceptuality. Basically, your mind is non-conceptual, engaging in the present moment with a visual image. No conceptuality present. And now what we are going to do is just eliminate the sensory input and just rest in what remains. And so what remains when you eliminate conceptualization and sensory input? It is just the sheer luminosity and cognizance of awareness. And so it's, you know, again, it's not that difficult to do for brief periods of time. And so do it for brief periods of time and then just keep going back to it and trying to, the periods of time that you're resting in this non-conceptuality, luminosity and bliss then just becomes longer and longer. And because our time is short now, we'll go right to basically the instruction for it. So we are going to, our practice here is going to start off with the visual again, and then basically we're just going to eliminate the visual and rest in what remains. So we eliminate the visual by closing our eyes. And so we'll rest then. There will be no conceptuality that we're bringing from the visual experience. Then the sensory shuts down, that our sensory object. And so what are you left with then? Sheer luminosity and cognizance. And so as you're trying to rest in what remains, basically just this sheer awareness, and what are you aware of? You're basically aware of luminosity and cognizance, awareness. So awareness is aware of awareness. This is the one thing that you really know. And you can become very, very stable in this, and that to become your whole session of just non-conceptuality and no sensory appearances. Or none that really distract you anyway. But what you might find is that there are still, at least for a time, there are appearances that arise. So that doesn't mean that there are no appearances, at least in the beginning, or the chattering mind just stops completely. So the advice of Yangtang Rinpoche, who is another of Lama Allen's Dzogchen Lamas who passed away 3 years ago or so in Sikkim and was a greatly realized Dzogchen master, is that while you are resting in this non-conceptual luminosity and bliss, you maintain introspection. So continuous introspective awareness so that you know when movement arises in the stillness of this non-conceptuality. And that movement could be a thought, you know, or a some mental appearance. And so what you do then is simply, Yangtang Rinpoche's advice is simply to note it as quickly as it arises. And so by doing that, by simply noting it, what you will perhaps notice is that by the act of noting it, you have created just enough distance so that the thought doesn't have an opportunity to capture you. And so the two things that we are trying to recognize as we are resting in this stillness is that objective appearances, the danger with objective appearances, meaning things that seem to be appearing to still awareness, our distraction, that we become fused with them and that we go off wandering with them. And the danger with subjective appearances, meaning that they appear to be a quality of the perceiving mind or the subject itself, is that we become identified with it. So in order to avoid this identification and the distraction, you have to note these appearances so that they don't sneak up behind you like with a chloroform rag and then throw you in the trunk and off you go wandering with them. So you have to be aware of them simply to note them, that like a thief at the window. And then as soon as the thief is recognized, they withdraw. And so what you may notice then is that as soon as you note these appearances, and this is exactly what Lama Tsongkhapa was talking about with the evolution of introspection. He says that you have to develop your quality of introspection to the point where you recognize distraction and dullness even before they are manifest, so while they are still incipient. And so this is exactly what this you can begin to become aware of while you are simply noting appearances in the moment they arise. And that is that they don't even fully form then. It's as if there's like a slight perturbation in the stillness of the field, and it doesn't even fully form as a thought or as a mental affliction or as a thought of the future or the past. It's just a slight little water bug on the surface of the pond, and it's gone. So the power of noting. And in order to be able to take advantage of that, it's very important that, as Trungpa Rinpoche said, you cannot be trying to experience because the moments of mind model, you know that mind occurs in the same way that time occurs, as a discrete succession of moments of awareness. And so if you are trying to notice the mind of the first moment with the mind of the second moment, the mind of the first moment has already gone out of existence. And so you can't have a present moment of experience of something that has already gone out of existence. So you have to have the mind of the first moment has to be aware of what's going on in this very moment rather than retrospectively. Which there is a lot of training that teaches that is exactly that the way that the mind operates. And in Gelugpa approaches, Shantideva is invoked as that's the way the mind works. But Mahamudra says that if that is your approach, you're never going to be able to make progress because your mind is going to be continually distracted because you will never be present with your mind. So the first moment, this moment of mind has to be present with continuous introspective awareness of what's going on in this mind right now. So let's try that as a 12-minute meditation. Begin with your eyes open and giving bare attention to an object directly in front of you, a coarse object, with bare attention. Engage it in the present moment. And let your introspection be continuous, noting when every conceptual thought tries to intrude, to define the object, identify it, or to go off wandering. Feel the experience of non-conceptuality. Engaging this appearance with this non-conceptual sense field. Now maintain this absence of conceptuality. And simply close your eyes. And rest in what remains. The luminous, cognizant nature of awareness. And now you can let your eyes be at least partially open. With your eyes gazing down, unfocused. Simply rest in the luminous, knowing nature of the mind. Rest in what remains. In the absence of conceptuality, and the absence of sensory input. It is stillness. But this stillness is not rooted in a spot. This stillness is as vast as space, with no center, no periphery. Let your awareness remain in the present moment. And what it knows in this present moment is simply luminosity and cognizance, the capacity of the mind to know. When thoughts bubble up, simply note them in the instant that they bubble up. Before they're fully formed, don't catch them a second or two after the fact, after they are present. If distracting thoughts intrude, release them into space and let your awareness expand in this stillness. And if your awareness begins to feel spaced out or lax, invigorate the luminous knowing. Release distraction into space. Invigorate by simply focusing on the luminosity of knowing. If distracting thoughts arise, release the energy they ride on into space. And then as you invigorate by enhancing the luminous awareness, maintain the spacious quality of your awareness. And as you release distraction into space, maintain the awareness of the luminosity. so that you come to feel this balance of spaciousness and luminosity. And simply rest with that. Rest your awareness in resplendent emptiness. Still and beyond conceptuality. So over this week, I invite you to use the practices that you know or use this sequence of beginning and end with no middle and really just begin to experience stillness. So a non-conceptual mind resting in only luminous cognizance. And you can do that for, you know, in the beginning, it may be for brief periods, but as you become more and more familiar with it, the periods become longer. And, you know, everyone enjoys this practice because it is so energizing, it is so relaxing, it is so peaceful, it is so tranquil. And so this is going to be the base then that we are going to use. This is not the goal in itself. This is just what becomes our object, actually, of investigation, the stillness in the mind that is still. So in order to have something to meditate on next week, I invite you to really become familiar with what this non-conceptual state feels like. And then everything, the questions that we pose as we are observing that mind directly, then become very, very powerful and transformative in breaking through our assumptions of that mind. Because as we will talk about in much detail next week, there is a vast difference between a conceptual knowing of meditation experience and a direct experience in meditation experience. So thank you all for coming. I hope it's been beneficial for you and give you something to work on this week. And we'll see you again next week, I hope.